Welcome to New Lens with Common Good Capital, where we talk with investors, RIAs, fund managers, and philanthropists about their experiences within the different impact investment themes, as well as explore the power of stewardship and capital. I'm your host, Jeff Schaefer, CEO of Common Good Capital, and today I'm here with Bill Kelly. Bill is the CEO of the CAIA Association. So if you've seen the accreditation for the CAIA, that's what he does. He's been there since 2014. There is some public news that he's acknowledged, so I'll let him address that, assuming that comes up. And then I think prior to that, you were in the asset management business, correct?
I was, and great to see you, Jeff. Thanks for having me on. But yeah, my career, it's hard to say and even think about, spans just over 40 years, and I can get into the segments of it. But most of it, when I started the specialized asset management last decade plus, has been, I would say, almost under the concept of stewardship, which we're going to get into as well, but serving end investors through education and transparency.
Well, I'm excited to have you on. Obviously, we've gotten to know each other the last couple of years, and I would say your career and my career have some parallels in the sense that having the alternative space, and then I transitioned to impact investing. And clearly, you have an interest in impact investing as well. So thanks for joining us. Let's start off and give us a high-level perspective of a bit of your background, where you grew up, you know, when it was school, and then just the big segments of your career.
Yeah, sure. So I grew up in Yonkers, New York, a decidedly solid middle-class community. And I think maybe true of that generation, my parents are very much about middle-class values. And I think that helped shape not only who I became, but my siblings as well. So went to college locally, Iona College, which some of you listeners may know, many may not. His claim to fame was Jim Valvano was the basketball coach for a number of years until he created the program with NCAA violations, and then he moved on to bigger and better things and unfortunately died too young. But the interesting aspect of Iona is that my parents very much wanted us to commute. They wanted us to stay under their roof as long as we could. And it had to be a religious Catholic college. Now, my wife is Jewish, 5 kids, none of them baptized. So maybe some of that didn't rub off on me. Some of it did. But I think the work ethic that I learned, I worked 40 hours plus a week while I went to college full time. Wow. At the same time as well, both teaching the value of education, the value of hard work. And I think that made me get into the workforce much earlier than many of my peers. But get out of college, joined Pricewaterhouse when it was just Pricewaterhouse, not PwC. And that was sort of the formative stages of my career. And I could talk about some of the middle legs, but not knowing where my career is going to go, Jeff, I think that sort of shaped me on the importance of credentials and what that meant to be a professional. And public accounting is a profession, even though it has its flaws. The art and science of money management is not. It's a very complex industry. But what we've tried to do through the CAIA Association is make it more professional one step at a time. But I've many stops in between my early days and where I was at CAIA, and happy to take you through some of that or maybe pause to see if there's an area you'd like me to focus on.
Why don't you I'm assuming most of our listeners are going to know of CAIA, but just give us a brief description of what CAIA, maybe when it started, what's the purpose of it?
Yeah, so started circa 2002, and well, not the beginnings of the endowment model, and the big Ivy League schools and their endowments had adopted a broader diversification beyond just public equity and public debt, probably decades before that. But institutional adoption was just taking hold probably around that time. And the CFA was very much focused on the traditional space and training an analyst who's coming into a buy-side asset management shop. But there wasn't a credential that really spoke to the CIO office, who's now allocated to this uncorrelated risk premium outside of the public markets. And it's a very different value proposition, the concept of due diligence, non-normal distributions, et cetera. It was very different animals. So out of that, CAIA was born, and it was really a very small operation. It was born out of the Eisenberg Business School at UMass Amherst, just 3 or 4 employees who are part-time CAIA, but maybe full-time at the university. And they got this thing off the ground. And it was really quite remarkable as I look back at it to see what they were able to create. And I think the thought was, could this be a global credential with very limited capital? And somehow, some way, they did make it work. And I think the primary reason why it was successful is the veracity of the underlying curriculum and really trying to put yourself in the shoes of the CIO and what she or he needs to think about when they allocate beyond the public market. So fast forward today, 22, 23 years later, We now have 14,000 members with the credential. There's about 6,000 people sitting for the exam annually. We have members in over 100 different countries. And right before we came on, Jeff, I was telling you, I just got back from London on Friday, heading off to Dublin today. And you said, you know, why the hell are you traveling so much? It is where the capital is. It's where the asset owners are. It's where the opportunity resides. So it is, the world is a big place. And we try to get to as many of these capital centers as we can. Not to prevent the flow of capital, encourage it, but encourage it through greater transparency, greater degrees of professionalism. And I do feel like an evangelist, because when I'm out there, I'm not trumpeting why you need to own alternatives. I'm trumpeting why you need to think about diversification and why education does matter. So it's been a great ride. And maybe the last point on this, you alluded to it in the intro. My retirement from Kai was announced early this year. So I'll formally be stepping down as CEO on 12/31. So this is kind of my grand finale to a very large degree. But I think committed voices can never be silenced. I'm still going to be very active. I sit on a couple of boards already, one in the 40 Act mutual fund space. So I'm going to continue to be active, vocal, and support Kaya where I can as well. I too have a podcast. I write for Kaya a lot. I'll speak for them publicly, periodically, but in a non-operational, non-governance role. So it's the beginning of my portfolio phase of life and very much looking forward to it.
So what's interesting as you talk, two things hit me. Number one, I personally got into the alternative investment space in 1997. I'd previously been with Van Camp and American Capital on the public market side. And so for me, you know, I remember when Kaya started to get out there, because that's the profession I'd been in. And I, just like you did, I got to watch from the trenches this question of, do I really need anything other than stocks and bonds in my portfolio? To today, that has been answered. In fact, the numbers that I remember in 2000, based on the way that we looked at the industry raised about $1 billion. And then that same industry kind of grew when I left the traditional alt space in like 2015, I think was about $22 billion. And then I think I watched the industry today and it's well over, I think, $100 and $125 billion. So we've seen that. So number one, I got to live that with you. Number two, it was fascinating. I was watching CNBC this weekend, and I don't even know who it was, but it was maybe it was the CEO of Apollo, but it was somebody from Apollo. And they were articulating, you know, where this whole alt space is going. And it's, I kind of had to sit there and go, duh. Because those of us who've grown up in this space, like you listen to him talk, like it's this newfound thing. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Now, he's obviously articulating what you and I believe. But it was just the way he was talking about it was almost like, oh, this is brand new. You're like, this isn't brand new at all. So anyway, just a few comments as you shared a little bit about your background.
I agree with everything you said, Jeff. I think what is new is the acceleration of this phase of democratization where it may be qualified investors or accredited investors, as the SEC defines it right now, but more and more we're going to find Mr. and Mrs. John Q. Public can't get access to alts. And I think as maybe a headline, good idea, bad idea, good idea. The news story is much more complicated. And I say that from the standpoint that this industry has gotten a lot more complex. Performance dispersion, meaning the returns from the median manager to the top quartile separated by thousands of basis points. Correlation at the median to public market proxies is approaching one. The fees are high. And the tax efficiency may not be so great. So if I'm the average retail investor and everybody's telling me I need all to my portfolio, who is helping me with due diligence? Who's helping me with manager selection? And do I have a chance after tax effect and fees of getting a differentiated return? And therein lies the problem. But I look at capital formation is a private matter. The small cap space, probably true in your career as well as mine, Jeff, is a very interesting place because it's very inefficient. You can get access through the public markets. Largely doesn't exist anymore because innovation is really happening early, late stage VC or in the growth equity space. And as an investor, you really can't play that game anymore in the public markets. And I heard a very good explanation and definition of alternatives from one of your DISA board members, Sylvia Kwan, in a panel with me. And she talked about not so much how much do you allocate to alts, but can I get exposure to all the risk premia I want to have access to in the public markets? And the answer is no. So she doesn't think about alts versus traditional. She thinks about diversification and the allocation of risk, not the allocation to specific buckets. And I thought it was an excellent way of thinking about it, because I think now too much of the discussion is, well, the 60-40 is dead to me, and you got to be now maybe 30-40-30. And does the end investor really understand what that means? But can they understand the nuance and the art of diversification? No, not all the eggs in the same basket, or all the same eggs in the one basket. And that's really the base level concept of diversification. So I think we're going to see this acceleration, because if you look at, pick any GP, Apollo, anybody else, Fund X plus one is going to have more and more retail assets in it, because we're not minting any new defined benefit plans anymore. Yep. The corporate space has been annuitized. So they recognize that the individual investor is a player.
Okay, so I got to go here. You, and I know you, so you're a smart guy. There's a real science behind this stuff, but yet you're still willing to come on and talk on a show that we talk about impact investing. So how do you reconcile that in your head of, wait a second, you've got this intellectual hard thesis side, and then some might say this touchy-feely, squishy side on the impact side?
I think if I could wave a magic wand and make one thing happen with great certainty, it would be to teach the investor, all investors, including institutional investors, the concept of long-termism. And I think we say we believe in it, but I think too many of us are inclined to pull the plug when there's a poor quarter or a news story comes out that I don't like. And has that changed the thesis? Most likely not. And I've heard several people say it, so I don't know who the attribution is, but this is the one industry where the merchandise is marked down and everybody runs out of the store as opposed to looking at it as an opportunity to come in and buy more. So maybe, Jermaine, to your question, I look at some of the risks that are talked about a lot, and broadly speaking, ESG, although I reject that as a notion, there's so many risk factors. Yeah. ESG, you're measuring everything and nothing, but let's focus on climate. And if that's a risk factor that I want exposure to, or you know, the change and weaning ourselves from CO2 or greenhouse gases, if I'm worried about whether or not I'm going to get dinged for that next quarter or a couple quarters out, most likely not. But as a long-term risk, should I be taking that into the construct of my portfolio today? And I think the answer there is absolutely yes. So I think that some people hear this concept of a double bottom line and it sounds nice, but are you conceding returns? If you're conceding returns as a fiduciary, you have no business making the allocation in the first place. But if you look at it through a long-term lens and think about some of these risks, and it can be about affordable housing or a quality to all investors, access to the same information that I have versus somebody else might have access to, a climate risk. Through a long-term lens, these risks are very much alive and well and should absolutely be taken into consideration. Maybe last point in this, Jeff, when I think about private markets, by design, and maybe less so by practice now, that's more patient capital. And it's very different than buying a stock on T plus one. And if I don't like it, I can sell it tomorrow versus a commitment to a fund. And if it's a drawdown fund, this could be 10-year money that I'm locking into. So I better have a 10-year horizon thinking about those risks and how I'm either allocating to risk factors I believe in or mitigating the risk elsewhere. I must have that type of an approach. If I don't, I don't have any business in coming into the fund.
The analogy that I've used in this, and like I've been in alts for probably 25 years, but we say mutual funds, ETF, stocks, you can date them. You can buy it today and sell it tomorrow. Generally, a private illiquid alternative, it's a marriage. You're holding this thing for the next 10 years. And contrary to what people think, you know, the knee-jerk reaction is, oh, well, I'm just locking my money up. And the other answer is no, you're actually tying your assets to the length of the assets that they need to be held. And then the other thing I've seen, in fact, I just had an example earlier this week where it was a friend I was talking to and their parents owned a real estate investment. And the real estate investment's been paying, let's say, you know, an 8% cash flow or whatever. And for some reason, there was a, you know, they're going to reduce the dividend for a season and hopefully it goes back up. And you just hear that, well, wait, first of all, if you understand what's happened with interest rates over the last couple of years, you can understand why that is. But I would imagine that the in the mind of this investor was not this idea that this is going to be a 7 to 10 year hold. It's just 3 year. And because interest rates had dropped so much over the last 10 years, unfortunately, people could flip this stuff every 2-3 years. And so this unrealistic expectation became the norm. And so I think we're seeing that's going to switch backwards for a portion of a portfolio. you shouldn't need liquidity. And if you do, then you shouldn't be in that investment. So anyways, okay, let me switch back here, because I'm going to ask a more philosophical question, because you're going to be retiring from Kaya. And so here's the question I have for you. How would you best describe who you are today in the context of where you're at in your life journey?
A very philosophical question. Yeah, I think with each passing decade, I think you get to know yourself a little bit more. You get to be much more comfortable in your own skin. And you realize that there are certain things that you can change, but many things you can't. But perhaps you could influence behavior to maybe bend that arc a little bit more in the right direction, recognizing that perfection maybe is not the goal. And it's been a very interesting, it'll be 11 years by the time I leave Kaya at the end of this year. And I've learned a lot in that 11 years. And a huge benefit of the job I'm in, Jeff, is the ability to go out and meet a lot of smart people in different aspects of this industry and learn from them. And I look at the pace of change, probably not quite the 11 years I've been at Kaya, but maybe the last five, unlike the first 35 plus years of my career, where things kind of moved at a pretty placid, sort of comfortable rate. And you didn't really have to worry about necessarily staying up to speed, although I absolutely encourage continuing education. But I look at the pace of change and disruption and now generative AI and decisions being made by bots and being able to use some of these tools to make smarter investment decisions. We really have to stay and remain students of this market. So I very much look at this next phase, Jeff, as not so much retiring, but maybe repotting myself. And family is very, very important to me, as I know it is to you as well. I've got five kids, four of them live outside of Massachusetts. And while I want to continue to be have a hand in the game, I also want to be able to do things with them as well. I'm not a grandfather yet, but maybe if I'm fortunate the next year or so, I'll be in that game as well, which I look forward to. But then there's been a lot of things I've sort of had to leave in the locker room, so to speak, not the least of which is some of the things I've learned from you about investment opportunities in places like Sub-Saharan Africa. And if I think about finding alpha, that used to be the name of the game by just dialing up any private equity manager. But I mentioned performance dispersion a moment ago. And the private markets have become more and more efficient, not inefficient. And if I think about what defines alpha, a lot of things, but pockets of inefficiency, the road less traveled. And while I tried to make it happen 2024, I failed, but maybe I can make one of these African trips.
And we'll get you there.
Yeah, my mutual friend Monica Miller, I just saw her. And it seems like a tremendous opportunity to really understand the power and the purpose of capital and how living proof, how the double bottom line really does work.
One more philosophical question, and this is going to sound grandiose, so you can answer it that way or it could be very simple. But clearly, you've made a difference in the lives of obviously your family, but then it's also professionally just in this transition to thinking differently about portfolio construction. But if I were to ask the question, how are you trying to change the world? How do you think about that?
Well, I think it's hard for any one individual to do that. And while I could tell you the reasons why, I think it would come off as maybe insincere or maybe even borderline arrogant. And what I've tried to do, and I think Kaya myself have been a little bit unique in this regard, is that, well, I very much believe in the mission and the power of Kaya. We're one association. And I was in visiting a similar type of association in Washington, D.C. Early on in my tenure, and slightly making this up, but probably not too out of bounds. I said to him, if I drew a circle maybe within 25-mile radius of Washington, D.C., you could probably find thousands and thousands of associations directly or tangentially focused on financial services, either as lobbyists, trade bodies, or organizations like Kaya. If they all blew up tomorrow, the world would still spin on its axis. And then I think about the end investor. And who is Kaya? Who is CFP? Who is FRM? Who's CFA? Who's CPA? And how do you guys kind of work together or not? And we've got to find ways of better creating partnerships with like-minded associations and do a much better job of explaining to the investor how we fit into this overall schematic, because I think there's just a lot of confusion. So I always begin any conversation with anybody about what can we do together. And I think oftentimes the answer I get right away is, well, what's in it for my members? And I say, forget your members for just one moment. And I never besmirch a Kaya Association member at all. But I say, we'll come back to the members. let's start with the client. And if we could do right by the client, right by the end investor, at the same time, right by society, I guarantee you, I could walk that back and my members will give me a bear hug. That's exactly what they want from me. But I think too many associations don't function that way. So I may have wandered off.
You didn't. And in fact, I'll just tell you, I think the first time I met you, call it 2 years ago, I actually do remember you basically saying that same thing to me, where you were very focused on the investor. So you were 2 years ago, you were saying that, and I didn't realize you were going to say that today as well. So you've obviously sat in some unique chairs, being an asset manager, being a Kaya and others. What does the power of capital mean to you? And how, where did that come from? Do you have any stories? What does it mean to you?
So maybe a few reference points. One, and I've mentioned this on at least one or two podcasts, maybe of my own in the past, but we get shaped by a lot of things. Our experiences, where we went to school, our friends, maybe fortunately, unfortunately, political views and mentors as well. But I had an early mentor in my career, Desi Heathwood, and he would always... And this is a for-profit, full-on capitalist asset management firm. His beginning mantra is, what would the client think? And I think he really taught me a very important lesson, which is the client isn't going to watch everything you do. And the fiduciary standard in the U.S. is wide enough you could drive several trucks through it. That gray area is quite wide and you're accountable to your actions. But if you sit down with the client and had to explain it, could you explain it? And if the coin falls your way, and sometimes if you have shareholders or partners, you've got a responsibility to them as well, just be in a position where you could comfortably disclose it and defend it. And they don't have to agree with you, but hiding things under a basket is never the way to approach it. So I think that was very, very formative in so many ways. And I can give you a recent example from just last week. I was over in London and a very good partner of ours, the Standard Board of Alternative Investment, SBAI, had a forum and they were very kind to invite me there. And it was a one-day event. And one of the keynote speakers was Roger Irwin. And some of your listeners may know Roger. He's been in this industry for a long, long time. And he's testament to why maybe people should never retire, just repot themselves. But he had a very successful career in various consultancies and actuarial firms. And now he was with Willis Towers Watson. And he started a think tank inside of Willis Towers called the Thinking Ahead Institute. And they put out a lot of unbiased research, even though they're part of WTW, they've got their own mission and own agenda. One of the things Roger said, and I don't think anybody in the room picked up on it other than me, he said, it is a privilege to work in this industry. And I went up and thanked him afterwards. Mm-hmm. And because I'm retiring, people want to sort of act like they care. And called me up on the stage. And I quoted Roger on that. I said, I would encourage all of you to think about what that short little sentence mm-hmm. should mean and does mean. Should mean to us and does mean to the end client. And if we could even get maybe 5% more of the people in the industry thinking that way, it would be awesome. So I don't know what that aha moment was, Jeff. But this is the only way I've known how to roll. And if you ask any of my colleagues, they'll say, you know, what really drives and influences Bill's thinking, putting the client first. And it's not something I do by day and act someplace else or act some different way at night. It's how I've always rolled. And there were some formative principles as to why that was the case.
You know, it's interesting you give that example because when I left traditional alternatives to come 100% to impact investing, and I don't mean to paint it as good and bad. When I stepped back into the old world that I had come from with this kind of impact lens, the word privilege, not in a negative sense, kept coming to my mind of like, hey, advisors, you're in here, you're working with your clients. And even your clients, the privilege that we have in America to be able to, and I'll just give an example, and forget about the example being the right or the wrong way to do it. But I mean, you could go on and download some app. And for as little as whatever it is today, $5, you can actually be an investor. You don't have to have $100,000 or private markets. I mean, countries would love to have the private markets that we have. And I think when you use the word privilege, it keeps coming back to my brain of like, yeah, all we think about, oh, if I'm going to invest in affordable housing, there's a risk. And all that's true. On the other hand, there's this side of, oh my gosh, how cool is it that with X amount of dollars, I can actually participate in that investment, create impact for those people, that normally other places don't even have the opportunity. So I love the word that you use there, because it reframes it and goes, man, there's a lot of blessings we have living in the environment, the time that we have. I mean, think about like commissions on stocks, but they're what, pennies today? They weren't 20 years ago.
Yeah. And the only maybe a thing I would take out of what you said, I agree with it all. But one point is that, yeah, I just get concerned about downloading an app. I think it makes every individual a trader, maybe not an investor. And every investor is a trader, but it doesn't work the other way around. And it's interesting, Robinhood, which really came into being during COVID, and even my youngest son, Will, at the time was 16, 17 years old. He comes home and he had a Robinhood account. I didn't even know he had money to invest, but I guess he's put some money in and off he went. And he very much was a trader, not an investor.
Right.
And Robinhood's business model is the most of their revenue comes from selling order flow. So they're giving price discovery to somebody else. So I think getting people on the grid, though, is a good thing. And I think what we've got to be cognizant of, Jeff, is that as we're getting more and more investors access to the private markets, I think one of the benefits is it prevents them from acting on their worst instincts, which is this is a long-term commitment.
Right. Right.
And I do recognize why we have to have interval funds and liquidity windows. That all makes great sense. But investors should understand why and how they should be using those. And it shouldn't be the ability just to get out whenever they want it for emergency purposes or reallocation or something else. So I think we've got to make sure that we could take the very best of what the private markets have to offer and not rinse out the value proposition and play to the investors' worst instincts.
So you used earlier in the discussion the word stewardship. What does stewardship mean to you? And give us some maybe example or two of how that plays out.
Yeah, so I think that most of us are probably stewards in many different verticals. And I feel with Kaya, it's not only my members, but the end investor. And I feel a responsibility to do right by them as a father. Both my wife, Liz, and I are stewards to our kids, and the list goes on and on. But yeah, I think that there's many decisions, micro and macro, that we make every single day when nobody is watching. And as I said earlier, some of them have to be for the benefit of an organization, but the benefit for Kaya is we're not-for-profit. So I don't have shareholders I represent. And I think it's almost liberating to some degree, because we are a pure play educational body focused on the investor. While my members can vote with their feet, and I hope the vote is always, I believe in what Kaya is doing generally, even though they may not agree with every single thing I do or the organization does, but there's no voting block that can vote us out of office or cause enough financial damage that we're going to have to sell our soul to think and act like the vast majority of our members. I think the vast majority of our members want us to do it the right way. That's what they signed up for in the course of the curriculum. So I think as it pertains to this conversation, Jeff, and your show, I'll focus on the stewardship of Kaya. And it's very interesting to see how this has gone, because when we started 20 years ago, the Common Fund or the Abu Dhabi Investment Authority were having folks come and sit for our exam. The most sophisticated investors in the world. And they came to us because they were curious. They want to know more about allocating beyond the public markets. But as investors, not as traders and investors, they know exactly what they're doing and they can kind of take care of themselves with or without Kaya. But as this next turn comes and you have less sophisticated institutional investors, and we go from accredited investors and family office down to the mass affluent, somebody's got to be able to speak on their behalf. And that, I think, is a big test for stewardship for ourselves, too. And how do we answer that bell? It's very, very complicated. We've got limited resources. And even if we do it right 10 out of 10 times, which is an awesome batting average, that's not going to be enough to move the needle. So it's not only how are we stewards of the end investors, how do we partner around that stewardship, which is something that I alluded to early, recognizing that it's not a profit motive for me. If I can go and work with somebody else to help affect better outcomes, the profit margin will take care of itself. It's going to lead to better outcomes for the end investor.
You mentioned earlier, as a fiduciary, if you can't get market rate returns or something like that, you shouldn't be, if you got to give up return, you shouldn't be investing. And I will echo that, which is probably not what people think coming from somebody who is focused on impact investing. But the reason why I would echo on it, yes, the fiduciary standard and all kind of stuff. But I also want people to know that sustainable models need to be created that also create amazing impact. Otherwise, that amazing impact isn't sustainable. And so the key in this impact space is how do you find these strategies, these managers that can generate market rate returns, frankly, maybe even alpha, but doing it, making a difference. And I think what I would say is I have seen more creativity and innovation around this impact space because of that. Because you're not just solving for financial returns, your financial returns plus the double bottom line, the triple bottom line. So the stewardship actually is even a bigger concept, because it's not just stewardship on financial returns, it's stewardship on these others. So anyways, I appreciate your comments on stewardship. You clearly live that out, just even the way that, you know, I've gotten to know you and the way you talk about investors. Let me switch to just and you can answer this from a personal perspective or if you want from a professional perspective. If you had a dream come true for your life between now and whenever you go to the pearly gates, I'm going to try to push you to stay away from your family because everybody wants to answer the family. Let's just assume that's a given. Is there anything that you'd love to see a dream come true between now and when you're at the pearly gates?
Maybe a couple things. I mentioned long-termism before, so I'll put that aside, although I think that's very important as well. But this next observation, Jeff, I think it plays into impact investing. So I look at trends both here in the U.S., the G20 countries, but then all the way over to sub-Saharan Africa, like Nigeria, which is going to be the second most populous country by 2050. And I look at income inequality domestically and globally, and it is unsustainable to not have middle and lower income success and moving in the same direction as upper income. And I look at, I'm on the tail end of the baby boomers. I joked with Desi Heath, who I mentioned before, that he's probably 30 years older than me, maybe 20 years older than me. And my cohort was always his exit strategy. When he needed to sell a house or something else,
right,
the tail end of the baby boomers picked it up. But at some point, they talk about, you know, the housing market in the U.S. There's all this inventory owned by aging baby boomers. Somebody has to buy that. And unless we have a functioning middle-income cohort, there's going to be no buyers. I look at the demographics in places like China, in South Korea, and the U.S., and certainly the U.S. is not where China is, but our replacement rate is not what it once was. Yep. Now, I'm helping. I'm one of seven, and I've got five kids myself, but very few people take that approach to life. But we've got to really be thinking about ways that we can get better quality. And if I look at the power of capital, it's an awesome opportunity to do that. And I said, one of the benefits of traveling, having been in London last week, I'd heard a little bit about the Mansion House reform. And what the UK government is trying to do is have the power of capital drive local economies in terms of innovation and early stage VC in infrastructure, in climate, in ports, in other disruptive technologies around AI. And if this goes to plan, the default portfolio for somebody opting into their version of a 401k plan will be 5% into quote-unquote alternatives. And the power of that capital and what that could mean to the local economy is enormous in terms of jobs and middle-class income levels rising too. So this is a big problem, I believe. And just like the retirement crisis is a big problem, Larry Fink just put out a survey to enough of a group that it's a reasonable sample. And the outlook, the individual on the street in terms of their own personal retirement is abysmal. And this is in the U.S. And if you get into some of these other economies, it's just very, very bad. We took a very sophisticated retirement makeup in a defined benefit space where somebody else took care of longevity risk. Somebody else took care of investment risk. Somebody else took care of geopolitical risk. And while you may have worried about the issue du jour in the Wall Street Journal or on CNBC, somebody else took care of that. Right. Yeah. So that's not true anymore. And even if you've got a 401k plan as a matching contribution and you retire in your 60s, do you know that you're going to be able to make it to the end? And I think I'm fortunate in that I've spent my career in this space. It has been a true privilege. The income earning levels and the capacity are very, very good, unlike many other industries out there. Your access to advice and investments is much better than maybe many other industries as well. But how do we equate that? And if we're going to give access to alternatives to the average person on the street, not bad. But what about advice? Do they know what they're doing? And I think we've got to be able to ask and answer that question. So I don't know if that sums up into one word. Maybe it's two. It's just I use inequality, and we've got to fix it across the spectrum.
Well, and clearly in the impact space, there are many themes, impact investment theme that are trying to solve those very issues. Yeah, I mean, it goes on and on. And So the funny thing is whether you care about these issues or not, you actually do and should, because it impacts the way our world functions.
Yeah, and it's going to rock my world tomorrow. If I look out the window, I could convince myself no. But after a series of tomorrows, it's going to have an impact. And I think, unfortunately, if you look at COVID as an example, the sovereign of the U.S. stepped up so quickly with a vaccine that I think people say, well, you know what? Climate, income inequality, food safety, water, somebody will fix this. And you could throw a Hail Mary pass into the end zone, and we did, and get a vaccine and stop people from dying. You cannot do that with the ozone layer. You cannot do that with the middle class. You cannot do that with food safety. And my fear is when it's almost too late, it is too late. And we really have got to be thinking about these very challenging issues before it's too late. And the power of capital can get it fixed.
Being in the trenches, and that's one of the reasons I do what I do, and we're trying to get the message out. I'm inspired every day by talking to a different asset manager who's got a unique thesis and a way to make a difference in the world. And so it's easy to think of CNN news, or pick any news you want, go to Fox for that matter, and all you hear is negative stuff. Look, this whole industry in the impact space is growing. Had a call yesterday with a guy, CFO, of multiple companies and over his lifetime, and he's 57, and he's like, look, I want to do something that's meaningful. Not that what he was doing wasn't meaningful, but at the end of the day, it was really working for private equity, just trying to generate profits. And so, I mean, there, and I can give you example after example of example where people are saying there is more to this just pure financial. Now, you got to have financial, because if you don't, then the world doesn't work. So be encouraged, because I see a lot of things happening. And one anecdote, I mean, we have a handful of RIAs who are going to pay their own way to go to Africa to experience it themselves. That's a big commitment financially. It's a big commitment time-wise. And yet there are people out there who are willing to do that so they can understand what's happening in the global economy. It's exciting times.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, I turned 65 a short couple of months, and I still think I have a third of my life left to live. And I look at the first third, you know, half of that I had no impact because I was young and in school. And these formative years, my 42 plus year career, has given me great insight, a great Rolodex, views that I very much believe in that I won't compromise on. And I'm hoping this next third will be better than the first two combined if I'm fortunate to have good health. And that's what I'm going to continue to do post 2024.
Well, clearly, if you just take your Kaya experience, that in and of itself, you amplify capital in the private markets. You've had a huge impact. Whether you can quantify it all or not, who knows? But well, I very much appreciate your time. It's always a pleasure having you, getting to know you more. And then just what I love is you have the intellectual rigor. And so having somebody like yourself come on here and talking about alternatives and that kind of stuff, and to see that it's more than just, I mean, there's a stewardship aspect. You clearly have you bring a different bent. So thanks so much. Don't forget to subscribe to A New Lens with Common Good Capital on your podcast app of choice. Please rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and Spotify. Although I think one of those is gone now, so I need to change that. New listeners hopefully find the show and put them on a path to a more fulfilling portfolio within the impact investment space. Bill, I hope one of these days we're in Africa together.
I certainly hope so. It was a gift to have been assigned you as a keynote moderator of several years ago at ADISA, and it's not only began a friendship, but a journey of learning, which hopefully the next step is Africa.
This podcast is a production of Common Good Capital and does not constitute an offer or a solicitation of an offer. Such offer would only be made through a private placement memorandum. Prospective investors in private placement securities should be aware that making an investment is speculative and involves a high degree of risk, including the risk of losing all or a portion of an investment. Investments of this nature are illiquid and subject to substantial restrictions upon transferability.